It's spoiler in time, my friends, which means we are going to talk about the shows we worked so hard on Cord Killers figuring out how to watch. This week, we're going to talk about Deadwood, Episode 5 of Season 3, Preacher, Season 3, Episode 5, and the movie Sorry to Bother You, which led to some hilarity in the theater where I went when they said, "Sorry to bother you, the theater is open." And people are like, "Okay, but for which movie?" I'm Tom Merritt, and he's Brian Brushwood.
Hey, man, I'm Brian Brushwood. As always, let's take a moment and peek in on our movie draft.
Why?
So it is firmly established. It is truly canon that Team John Trekker utterly slayed it with $834 million and counting. It looks like, Mission Impossible Fallout has a chance to take them over the $1 billion mark.
Oh, it will almost certainly take them over the $1 billion mark. They need, what, $170 million out of it? It will make $170 million. It's being touted by the critics as the best Mission Impossible that has ever been made.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. Well, congrats to them, and who cares about the rest of us? Let's talk about movies.
Congratulations, John Trekker. All right. Let's talk about Sorry to Bother You, the movie Sorry to Bother You, which is personally fun the way Black Panther was fun, in that it's set in Oakland. So there's even more of those moments where I'm like, I'm pretty sure I know that lot. Oh, now they're in West Oakland. Okay, I know where that is. You know, and there's a little bit of that element of slacker that I had when I lived in Austin, where I'm
sure.
They couldn't have got from that bar to there that quick. But none of that really took me out of it. And all of that paled, those little tiny pieces paled in comparison to the things I loved about the movie, which is that every moment that I thought, yeah, I heard this movie was weird, I guess I can kind of see it, it would get weirder until there were Equisapiens.
Yeah.
I think that was when it hit peak weirdness at that point.
Even having heard Tom's words, if there's a chance that you could still go in to see this movie.
It is spoiler in time. Like, the point of this show is to spoil people, but carry on.
But this is an unusual movie in that of its gifts, the greatest is a genuine surprise. It is also one of the rarest I have experienced in the movie theater. And I definitely experienced surprise. Also along the way, times of boredom, times of deep anxiety, feeling like precursor to a full-on panic attack, like anxiety attack. And I've never been less comfortable to be a white person in a movie theater.
Oh, really?
When I watched, just that one moment.
Which moment again?
When they made him rap.
Oh, yeah. No, that was an uncomfortable moment.
That was
just an uncomfortable moment. I have seen that sort of thing happen in real life.
I believe
not, it. Not to that level of exaggeration, but that conversation of like, so you can rap, right? And the guy's like, no, I can't rap. Like, oh, come on. You know, and they didn't make that person perform. So again, not to that level of exaggeration, but I'm like, oh yeah, that is bullshit that happens.
Yeah. So, man, hard left turn. Let's assume you've seen the movie.
That's the point of the show, Brian, is that we're spoiling people.
I know, but this is a precious gem that needs to be handled delicately.
Everything we talk about in Spoiler in Time should be like this.
Okay.
Which is, if you haven't seen it and you don't want to be spoiled, go away. And if you have seen it, we're going to just talk about it.
Okay. I guess the only difference is, like, normally I don't care, like,
normally I don't care about spoiling people.
Well, yeah. Normally I'm like, yeah, we're going to talk about it. You can like it or not like it. But what I'm saying is that this is one of the few examples where it's like, even if you don't think you want to see it, you know, sometimes you'll hear a review and it will cause you to want to see it. This is not one of those movies. That's not what we do here. Yeah,
that's
correct.
This is not reviews.
So this movie successfully opened with an instantly identifiable thing. Main character sitting there in his bedroom saying a version of words you have heard me say on this stream that I said in the Texas Monthly podcast, where it's like, look, you know, our dumb, stupid bodies crumble into dust. And if you're very, very lucky, then you've sung a song that echoes just a little bit longer than your dumb, stupid body. But and he takes it a step farther. Like, what does it matter? The sun's going to explode or whatever. And meanwhile, you've got his wife who or his girlfriend who lives in the moment and is like, no, it's fine. What we have, the present, it's a gift. And so on. I'm like, I'm in on this. He goes to work in a corporate environment where he feels like he's selling his soul. And meanwhile, what he wants to do is whatever the song in his heart is. I'm like, oh my God, I so identify with this. And then, you know, the theatrical conceits, the universe is crazy, directing styles awesome and all that stuff. But then at some point, I recognize the difference between, Brian doesn't just identify with this character to remind him of what it was like to work at Dell in 1999. Now Brian just bought property and is a boss to people or whatever. And so as a result, all of the rich, evil corporate Americans or whatever, like that was just like, oh my God. There was this moment, the panic I felt like if even one person thought that what they're showing is who I am, like it, there was this brief flash of me. It's so excoriating, so visceral, so harsh that I had a flash of like, I'll sell everything. I'll sell everything. I'll tell everyone they're fired. And I'll just, I don't know that I could stand up to that judgment. So I'm going through this big, journey.
So you regret the idea of housing people in limited situations to work for you at guaranteed wages and turning them into horses you're saying.
We've leaned in on all the hilarious cult compound imagery or whatever, but this movie made all of that very not funny to me suddenly, you know?
Yeah.
And then so they successfully convinced me that corporate America is a piece of garbage. They convinced me that the main character is a piece of garbage because he can't keep a promise to his friends. And then they even managed to convince me that his girlfriend is a piece of garbage because for all her talk about doing your own thing and being true to yourself, turns out she's exactly the sellout that she is and turns on her Lily Allen voice to sell art to rich people. And so here we are at the end of the second act. And I think, okay, Mr. Director, you done did it. You really made me feel what a problem we have in all of society. I'm ready for your answer. What's the right answer? And the answer is, I don't know. I'm going to make a horror movie. And it just
Really see that. That's not how I see this movie at all.
Really?
I see this movie so differently.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Because what I perceived it as is it's They Live for the 21st century. It's doing a interesting job through parody and over the topness of telling, you know, very real harsh truths about the ugly parts of capitalism and so on. And then,
but you didn't feel like Cassius reached a resolution with those things?
Only in a insanely cartoonish way. Like he did for the sake of the movie, but I was left with no believable answers in introspection afterwards.
Or
right?
Any subtext?
I mean, what would the subtext be? He tried. Everything he tried didn't matter. He ultimately failed in everything. Everything was a failure. He only succeeded in getting revenge for his anger. You know, he tried going out. He tried subjecting himself to the slings and arrow of all of the trolls online to tell his story. And he finally got his video shown. Then he got the brief one day long euphoric high of being a guy telling people take action, call your senators or whatever. But ultimately, you know, immediately that turned out to be nothing. And then, you know, they complete his Campbellian arc they even write on the nose, say, well, I couldn't come back to the garage. I couldn't come back home exactly the same, could I? And then double middle fingers. Whatever, I'm a horse now, and then credits roll, and then come back just long enough, like, oh, but you probably want resolution, so here he is murdering a guy. Anyway, now we're out. That movie was insane, and I love that it exists. Weird. I love that it made me so uncomfortable. I loved we could spend 2 hours teasing apart every individually clever thing that they did, from the casting to the design to the shape of the world. I loved everything about it, and it made me feel some hard things and think some hard thoughts, and also utterly surprised and delighted me at times. I think it's an important movie, and I liked it a lot.
Cool. I saw somewhat of a different movie, but I feel the same way about it in the end. So I'm not sure how important that is, but I felt like these people were real and their world is so cartoony, but in because of the contrast, their feelings and the way they feel feels more real. Most people feel the way these people feel in that they don't think they can get ahead against a rigged system. And so the only way to get ahead is to trick the system and or luck into something, which happened. Both of those things happen, or fight against it, which also happens. And even if you do that, you won't win. And I felt like that was one of the central messages here is like, yeah, we have a system where the majority of people have the odds so stacked against them that it is unlikely they can rise. And even if they do rise, most of the time, they aren't going to rise the way they thought, and they might have to be doing things that they are uncomfortable with. It's not a literal movie. It's imparting like, this is how a lot of people feel. Maybe they shouldn't feel that way. I don't know. But this is how a lot of people feel. And this movie, because it doesn't try to show it in a realistic way, I think is all the more successful for that. Like, who knows? Like, we can have an argument about, you know, whether this or that company is actually being good to people and giving them proper things. But forget about that. Way people feel is they're turning people into horses. Like, let's just get past the nitty gritty and the niggling fights. Let's actually just punch you in the gut. So I didn't feel like it was a horror movie. I felt like it was a commentary on social structure and class and race and what it's like for most people in this society. Does it have a solution? No. And I don't think it ever pretended like it was going to. It was trying to call attention like, hey, folks, we can ignore this. We can brush it away and say, I guess it's not a problem, but it doesn't make it go away. We need to pay attention to this. And the silliness around it helps bring that point out for me. I also agree that in the end, it was a little on the nose hero's journey, like, well, I guess I couldn't come back the same. And then he turns into a horse and gets his revenge, which is a feel good moment, which I, you know, I think was more of done as like a horror movie beat, right? Like, oh, it's not dead yet, right? But yeah, in the end, I also agree this is important. We could spend all night teasing out all the clever bits of it, but Boots Riley has got some things to say. And I think the fact that we both found very legitimate meanings that are different out of it is a testament to the fractal nature of how he constructed this movie.
Bryce, I do want to do a victory lap where we can heap praise on all of our favorite moments because there were so many great bits in it. But before we do, I would love to hear your overall take on it.
I was glad to hear you liked it because part of the reason I recommended it to you was a little bit because of your second realization of it, and that not that you are selling nuclear devices or enslaving people, but the fact that you were an office worker,
sure,
turned management, yeah, you know,
sure,
and the worker dynamics that capitalism encourages were in that, and it was interesting to hear, you know, that.
Well, and I think one of the things that is different about your perspective, Brian, is you didn't wait to become a power caller. You said F this power caller stuff. And you did something that we don't see in the movie, which is someone striking out on their own.
Well, and you know, that's so this is one of the things the movie did was it created a distortive caricature of, you know, a lot of people, young artists trying to strike out on their own will reach out to me, and I love talking to them and, you know, doing my best to tell them the truth as I see it and give suggestions or whatever. And so many of those messages appear in distorted formats coming from what clearly are the villains in the corporate structure. And it's like that was profoundly disturbing for me to hear and to experience. And like, man, dude, when I'm trying to say this, is that what's being heard or whatever? And I think that's a testament.
That's what's so beautiful is like, it makes you think about it. And now when you say it, you're going to say it in a way that doesn't mean that. Because you're going to have that in the back of your mind.
Certainly going to be more aware.
Because cash, what happens with cash is he's like, I need to save my uncle's house. Yeah. I can't wait around. I've got to get the cash. And a lot of people feel that pressure. They feel like that's what they have to do to step up. Like, I guess I have to be a power caller. I have to take this, even if it betrays my friends, because it's the right thing to do. I got to get that cash.
Yeah.
Because I'm Cash. Also because I'm named Cash.
Also Cash Green.
Green is so good. But they even play on that, right? It's like, what color is Cash? Cash is green.
Yeah. You
know, like, they play into it. If we're talking like favorite moments, the entire sequence from watching the Michelle Dongri animation.
That's definitely like a Michelle Gondry. Do you think that was actually like uncredited, directed by actual Michelle Gondry in there, or do you think that was just like we're riffing on that style?
I would guess it's riffing. I mean, it was pretty well done. I don't know. I could see both ways.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But the entire thing of like him just trying to get him to watch this movie, and then he finds the horse guy and he's like, "You need to watch the movie first." And he sits him down to watch the
movie. And of course, he keeps promising, like, "You won't even be freaked out once you see the movie." And of course, the movie does nothing to assuage the freaked outness.
Right. Well, like the narrator of that is like this cave woman with her breasts out and
constantly jiggling boobs. Yeah.
That entire sequence was really well done, and a very good use of like building tension and releasing tension in very unconventional pace. I think it was really good.
Yeah. Loved.
And I like the white voice construct because it's a thing. It's a real thing. And they satirize it so hard that it's ridiculous. Right. But they also point out that it's a thing that even his girlfriend has, because we all have that different way of presenting ourselves in a situation where we think we need to impress or persuade. Yeah. None of us are the same all the time.
Yeah.
And so it's like, are you fake, or are you just putting on your white voice in order to, and are those the same things? There's so many interesting things that brings up.
Very much enjoyed figuring out, oh God, that's David Cross. And then later, that's Patton Oswalt.
It's Steve Buscemi who does the other white voice.
The Danny Glover's?
Danny Glover's
white voice. I didn't know that one.
It's very short. He only gets like one or two lines, but that's Steve Buscemi.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Did you have a favorite moment, Tom? Did we get?
I don't know if I have a favorite moment. I have a hard time picking a thing out of this. I mean, there are moments that will stick out in my mind, like when he first meets the horse person in the bathroom. that will never go away.
To me,
and Equisapiens roll out when they all.
Oh my God! The full on Autobot moment of like, anyway, we're superheroes now,
and their dong flopping around everywhere.
I liked the fact that in the very beginning, they progressively clue you in to how absurdist this movie is going to get by constantly subverting stuff. Like, we understand it's a dystopian, not so great future or whatever, but it's like the fact that his car is constantly smoking, not just a little, but in this cartoonish amount. The fact that when he's driving, he's clearly not even touching the wheel or looking at the road or whatever. And then, you know, it's raining, so let's take a piece of string.
And it doesn't even work,
you know? but of all those little beats, the one that made me happiest is when he pulls into the gas station and says 40 on pump 12 and it slams down 40 cents. Like, oh, I get it. It's really bad for him right now. What a journey. What a journey that movie was. Yeah. But also there was definitely extended periods where I was like, okay, how long? What's going on?
Weird. I feel like there were slower bits.
Yeah, for
but
me,
I never
checked the watch.
Yeah. I'm normally not a watch checker, but But normally I get sucked in and I don't even think how far are we in the traditional Hollywood story. Mm-hmm. But I definitely did on this one. And I think it's just because there were some moments that he took Quentin Tarantino, like, you know, relaxed, like, you know, let this moment soak in. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, a little longer than I'd like to be here, but okay.
I thought it was amazing.
It was
awesome.
It was amazing. Amazing is a great word for it, because that doesn't necessarily mean it was entirely pleasant or fun the entire time. But it did give me, as I mentioned, the most precious gift is a genuine surprise. And hoo boy, is there genuine surprise?
Maybe I'm making this up now, but I just kind of had a different take on the name, which is, sorry to bother you. We know you wanted a like nice, easy fantasy movie, but this movie is going to be unpleasant.
Sorry to bother you because you most certainly are about to become bothered.
Yeah.
Welcome to our movie.
All right. Shall we move on to Preacher then?
Yeah, if we have to. Man, I just want to keep talking about that other movie. That's fine. Preacher continues to be pure joy every time I click on it. I can't think of another television show that no matter what mood I'm in, no matter how busy I am, because I was working on Cord Killer stuff right up until we were going to go live. And I noticed, I was like, hey, I got 40 minutes. I can get almost all of Preacher in. I hit play and instantly I was just happy. It was, I just love what they're doing. The latest thing I've noticed is Tulip, I guess they're just leaning heavily into her just saying at all times whatever they think the audience is probably thinking. And I thought that I'm loving it. Like, well, why don't I just kill you? That would make sense. That would break a spell, right? And there's like, well, why are you doing this? Why wouldn't you? Questioning motivations, all that.
So this episode particularly, we have three tracks: the Tulip, Cassidy, and Jesse track. The Tulip track is, how can I kill Grandma? And how, you know, and once I've been captured, how can I escape and go kill Grandma? The Jesse track is, how do I get out of the box? And there's a, you know, it's a little MacGyverish plot line there. But my favorite in this particular episode was Cassidy. Cassidy just, you know, like, kind of bored, buying elephant tranquilizers, looking for a vampire date, realizing, oh wait, she's not a real vampire, she's play vampire, this pisses me off, I'm just gonna get drunk. And I guess there's the track of Humperdoo and the Grail Society deciding that they need to get Jesse, and Cassidy being, you know, the whatchamacallit for that, the dupe for that. But that's more set up for the next episode. This was just a kind of a fun, let's watch the three people move through their life sort of episode, and I enjoyed that.
There was two things that seemed new to me. One is Hare Star as middle manager. Only see him be the supreme badass of this stuff. And instead, you know, that plastic grin as he's trying to agree with what the boss says. Yeah, you think that's okay. Well, let's see what we can do. And then separately, that opening fight, as silly and weird as it was with Tulip and Jesse and the two hillbilly twins or whatever. Like, at one point, they even announce out loud, oh, we're doing an improvised bathroom weapon fight, are we? And then they can sit, then they do these things. I loved that. Was just
a
toothbrush.
Enough. What are you going to do with that? You're like, you in the face.
It was just the right amount. Just the right amount of a reminder that we're, you know, a silly TV show. And like Tulip even says, look, man, we got to wrap this up. There's like important, fun stuff we're supposed to be doing. We can't be stuck here. And it's like, that's what the audience is thinking. How are you going to get out of this?
Yeah. And honestly, this episode was really kind of bringing us to those points. Cassidy is now under the control of the Grail. They're going to try to use him against Jesse. They're coming for Jesse and try to bring him back on their side. And the Grandma and Tulip's connection has been finally brought to a head where they know if they kill Grandma, that kills Tulip. So how do they figure out how to get Grandma to break the pact or end the pact without having to pay the debt?
Yeah.
Unless they can pay the debt, I guess.
So they've come to an impasse, or as they call it in England, an impasse, or as they call it in Mexico, a regular standoff.
Mm-hmm.
That is a line I stole from Dan Harmon's podcast that I just loved. And if you're not listening, you should listen to Harmontown.
Let's, shall we move on to Deadwood then?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
All right. Deadwood. What happened in Deadwood?
I guess here's what I would like to believe happened in Deadwood. At the writer's meeting, somebody said, what if we did just a straight up 30-minute pro wrestling match?
Oh, right. Because we get the Doherty fight, which ends up unexpectedly with Doherty winning, but it's an epic wrestling battle.
It was like 30 minutes long. And it turns out that of all his injuries, his feelings were hurt the hardest. That was actually, I did appreciate the way they represented Dan. He's been a fairly one-dimensional bully, and we've seen him kill somebody. But that moment when they're trying to make Dan feel better, they're like, he won't come out. He's stuck in there. You want to go talk to him, boss? And Swearingen quite rightly says, if he wants me, he will ask for me. What he's really dealing with the fact is that he ended a man's life and watched the light go out of his eyes by his own hands. He's not done that a lot. And
no one else is going to help him. He's going to walk this road alone.
Right. And then separate, I guess we also saw Raylan arrest Hurst.
You mean Bullock? Yes.
Sure.
Well, Hostetler, we got the Hostetler deal done, but then it ended up with Hostetler killing himself. That was another major moment. Because they couldn't find, they finished the deal, but they couldn't find the board that they had gotten Steve to sign.
Oh, that's right. That's right. And then even when they did find it, they didn't believe it. And so there was no
and
peace.
The Hostetler was like, fine, you know what? I'm never going to win. Yeah. There's always going to be somebody like Steve that won't let me off. So forget it. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And then Bullock grabs Hurst by the ear.
I thought that was really interesting. I also functional, I think. I think he held the gun in his hand, but he didn't say under threat of death move. He said under threat of pain move the direction I'm going, or it will be unpleasant for you. That felt like kind of exactly how it probably would have gone in that situation.
And I imagine Bullock would have done it with Captain Turner about or not, but it certainly would have been an entirely different situation had Turner been there.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think? Do you think this just blows over or turns in, or is this a flashpoint with her? I mean, he can't possibly get away with this.
Well, and that's what's weird is they're a territory, an unrecognized territory. So it's not like Hurst can call upon the state government to intervene, which I would think normally he would. He's got to bring other forces to bear. And the most current force he had was Turner. So with Turner dead, the next best thing he's got locally is freaking Cy Tolliver, which appears to be entirely ineffective. But I guess that's probably going to be the agent of pressure next. I also imagine that Hurst has some other things up his sleeve that he can do. Like maybe he can undermine the bank somehow or something. I don't know. Like he's probably got other levers to pull that we will see.
So I found myself a little bit confused about one of my favorite vignettes in this episode, because on the one hand, it looks like Alma's back on the sauce, the laudanum. But on the flip side, like, so whatever upsetness I have about that was overruled by, it also looked like she was trying to have a healthy relationship with her husband. And I guess they got to the point where they almost got it on, but then he said, I'll see you to arrangements or whatever. Like
he got spooked. Yeah. I couldn't quite figure it out. If he was just scared that she was going to regret it or if he was nervous or what,
he didn't deserve it, or it was more than he could be or do for her in that moment, or maybe he, even as much as she is trying to hide it, already suspects that she's back on the sauce. Or
I think it probably has the most to do with him feeling like she doesn't mean this. I'm undeserving. This is a trick, and I don't want to make a mistake.
Yeah, but it was strangely so sweet and genuine. I don't know. I'm sad that she was high during it. but meanwhile, during that epic wrestling scene, that moment where both Hurst and Swearingen just acting like they're Kermit with the Lipton tea, and that what's happening below isn't a proxy battle between the two of them, that was some amazing tension.
Oh. What's happening in the thoroughfare? A fisticuffs, I see. Interesting.
How about that?
Exactly.
Although, did they firmly establish in the previous episode that this would be the proxy war between them? Like, it felt like everybody understood that.
Yeah,
but I couldn't remember the exact moment that it was. But then again, they speak in those.
I think it was more of a, well, I guess we'll go ahead and make this the proxy war then, Dan. Go fight.
Yeah. I guess it's just sort of understood between all parties that's what's happening.
Well, that is it for this episode of Spoiler in Time. Folks, you'll get these episodes a little earlier if you're a patron at patreon.com/cordkillers, as well as After Talk, where Bryce and Brian and I chat about all kinds of things. And you only get that as a patron at patreon.com/cordkillers. We'll spoil you again next time.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.